The time is June 1990 when Detroit's favorite cyborg cop returns to clean up the streets, this time facing a drug-dealing cult leader named Kane, along with his child apprentice, Hob, and corporate PR team that turns him into a walking after-school special. While RoboCop deals with our evil corporate OCP, reprogramming our hero as a distraction, the company tries to privatize everything but the air we breathe, including owning the entire city of Detroit. This go-around, RoboCop faces more corporate greed, reprogramming a city under distress, a gun-wielding dangerous 12-year-old, and a drug lord turned cyborg. This week on Back to the Balcony, we discuss the 1990 sequel, RoboCop 2.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your host Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
Now, I know with all of our episodes, all of our meetings, we've never talked RoboCop. And I have to say, even going into the third one, I am a fan. The cartoon series, the merchandise, give me anything RoboCop and I'm bought in. Even the cheesy TV movies that they produced. I love it. It is a brilliant marketing campaign. It was an adult theme that you knew kids were going to love, and that's why they came out with an animated cartoon. This is one of those that you snuck out of the room to watch because you knew you weren't supposed to watch it, but you're gonna. RoboCop 2 is still one of my go-tos.
Yeah, RoboCop and Rambo, man. I'm going to say those are the two R-rated franchises that they really shoved down kids' throats in the 80s and early 90s, and I was all for it. I had all the Rambo toys and I had all the RoboCop toys because, yeah, I was a RoboCop stan. I was 7 years old when I saw the first one in the theater with my dad, and I was 9 years old when I saw this one in the theater with him, too. And yes, okay, there is going to be that eternal argument that it is the inferior sequel. But you can only say that because the first one is so damn good that it's hard to compare anything to it. I personally think that RoboCop 2 kind of stands on its own for being different enough from the first one, but still existing in the same universe, but turning the volume up to like 15, right? Maybe even 20. The best thing about RoboCop 2 is that it doesn't even try to compete with the first one. It goes its own direction, and where the first one was cynical with the Reaganomics, right? The era of Reagan, the consumerism, the capitalism, the corporationalism. I mean, I've already talked about this three times on the Cult Worthy in the last couple months of RoboCop on my political episode, on my episode with Josh Scar, and now we're talking about it now. It is kind of like holding a mirror, a satirical mirror to the face of society in 1987. But when RoboCop 2 comes out, think about what was big in 1990. It was the war on drugs. It was the DARE program. We had the video game Narc, where you were essentially a narcotics agent blowing up drug dealers in the street, right? And what RoboCop 2 does is it kind of holds the mirror up against the ridiculousness of the DARE program and almost dares to say that drugs are awesome in its RoboCop satirical fashion. And how does it do it? With crazy killer robots, a 12-year-old drug dealer kingpin, and just more violence, more anarchy, more blood, and some more humor. So yeah, I think RoboCop 2 stands on its own as a sequel that is just as good in theory, but maybe not as good in execution.
And that's where I'm probably going to get a lot of flack, because I hold these two at almost the same standard. I think
it's really close.
It's really close. Because I think you nailed it, is RoboCop 1 really did attack where the world was. It was almost a nightmarish thing for a kid, where it stood in the back of your mind saying, I hope we don't get to this point. I hope the world doesn't come to this. And it is a world where you almost feared, after watching this movie, going out of your house as a kid. But when we get into the second one, this is where it does a really great job, is that it stays with that commentary. Because in the 1990, we had the spike in heroin. We had this huge thing that RoboCop 2, you can tell, really zeroes in on that type of addiction. And this is where that fear, it's a different type of fear mixed in with a sci-fi thriller or action, whatever you want to call it. But you add a child into it. When you already brought it up, the war on drugs, this was huge at this time, where we have how drugs are affecting our youth, the dare to say no piece of it. You add a kid into a film with RoboCop, surrounded around this very terrifying drug, and this is almost braver than the first film. Is it takes a brilliant and bold filmmaker and writer from Frank Miller, who was suffering from addiction at this point, I believe, to really go and give an example of this is what can happen. And it is a very dirty, gritty movie. And as a kid, this is something just as terrifying as the first one. We have where the world is in the first one, and this is where you can be in terms of drugs now. So both of them, I hold to the same kind of standard, is they go after a social commentary that is extremely bold, creative, and imaginative. You lose a little bit, I think, of humor in the second one, in my opinion, because we do have a heavy topic here. So I think this one is a lot braver than the first one.
It's a different kind of humor, because in the first one, you know, you got your screenwriters, Ed Neumeier and Michael Miner, for the first one, they're doing just real kind of almost like British humor on takes the satirical parts of how the media operates and the commercialism and the commercials and the advertisements, the things that people are distracted by in a world that's falling apart. That was the main focus of the first one. In the second one, there is a lot of that, but when you add Frank Miller into the mix, you get more comic book aesthetic and comic book structure. And I like that. I like that it differentiates itself from the first one. The villains are more diabolical, because where in the first one, they're wicked, but they're businessmen. In this one, it is a cult of the drug, and the drug is called Nuke. So you've got a double satirical stance on what was going on sociologically at the time. The things that we were afraid of, the drugs and the nuclear weapons, right? And they put them together. So when you have Kane, played by Tom Noonan, he's kind of like this cult leader figure, almost like a religious figure based on the addiction of this nuke drug. And that's what differentiates it from the first one, where we take it out of the corporate lens and turn it into more of this kind of cultish religious sect. And that's what kind of makes it different. That's where it does feel more like Sin City or Frank Miller's Batman graphic novels. And that's a good thing. And just like I think a good sequel, where I kind of do like the Batman sequels better than the first one, in both instances of the Tim Burton ones and the Christopher Nolan ones, when the villains and the world become more interesting than the hero itself. So what RoboCop does in the sequel is it takes a lot of the attention off of Murphy. It takes a lot of the attention off of RoboCop, and it spends more time with the villains, the corporation, and the world that RoboCop exists in. And that can be very distracting and frustrating for audiences that are there for RoboCop. You know, Rambo would never do that. Everything's built around Rambo. But in RoboCop 2, and even in RoboCop 3, it's the world around RoboCop that he exists in. And I think that's what disappointed a lot of audience members and critics at the time, is that this doesn't feel like a RoboCop movie because we spend so much time with these wicked people. And I personally like that. I think it's a good distraction from what you can do with that suit and how much exposure you want to do with this character before it stops feeling real.
Well, I like it because, kind of taking on to what you said, it goes after a couple different elements here. If you're going to involve a young boy as a villain, you know you have to have some substance to it. You know you have to cover every ground that you have. And even when we get to that scene in the arcade, it reminded me of the Ninja Turtles movie, where it doesn't glorify in that arcade scene, where it doesn't glorify it. It's almost a dark, gritty, where you don't want to be tempted or glorifying the scene, but it's still enticing on what's going to happen next. But you also have an emotional level to it that you have to balance the good versus evil. And what is good versus evil? And we have that scene where we don't get a lot of RoboCop compared to the first one. But when he is there, it's always a forte, because we have him where he's discovering a human element, where he gets reprogrammed, where we feel for him. We have that scene where he makes that suicidal almost choice to reprogram himself, where the cops carry him in. And there's an emotional level on both aspects, between good and bad. Even all the way when we go to the climax, where we have the Hobbs scene of laying in the armored car. So all this is leading to something where Miller didn't want to have another RoboCop movie. He wanted to have an impact. He wanted a message to be told. And this one had a bigger emotional impact than I think the first one did, because you're right, it wasn't as cynical. It was more
nihilistic is what it was. Like, it stopped caring about the human drama and focused more on like the downfall of the humans. And in a sense that the robots, and we could say even AI, might have it right, like, because they take emotion out of the calculation of what they're doing. And you're focused on the boy right now, and so were our critics when we get to that. And I think I really nailed it on this last viewing. I think what it is because of the generation, our generation, and the one like slightly before us, like the very young Gen Xers, we were kind of a generation of latchkey kids, right? And this was kind of a cautionary tale of, same with Ninja Turtles. If you don't pay attention to your children, if you just let them do their thing while you're off going to cocktail parties or swinger parties, whatever it is the boomers were doing, this is what your kids are going to be up to. And RoboCop 2 pushes the envelope. It's like, okay, you're going to let your kid play around in the streets while you're off doing your own thing? Well, guess what? This is what could happen. Now, it's taking it to an extreme level, but it's very relevant of that generation, where it's like, our parents had no problem letting us just go. Go off and explore the neighborhoods, be back by dark. We had the commercials when we were a kid saying, hey, it's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your kids are? Well, we know where Hob was. He was running a drug empire, right? And special recognition to Gabriel Damon, who plays Hob. One of my favorite villains of the 90s, and we've already talked about him once with our Newsies episode, and then not many people will recognize him, but he was the voice of Littlefoot in The Land Before Time. So he definitely had some real watermarks on the 80s and 90s in cinema, with one of the most popular animated films of all time, RoboCop 2, and then your favorite, Newsies.
Absolute favorite. And I think his career ended way too soon, because he does even our disagreement about Newsies, everything that he has noted has been fantastic. His performance is spot on. Even when he is playing an advanced role against some veteran actors, he is still at top form here, and he is diabolical. We find him a threat, and to find a kid a threat, that is true talent. So I think when it comes to seeing what his potential was, it's a shame we didn't see more of him. But at the same time, again, opinions out there, this one, he left on a high note, because it is an absolute memorable role. And his last scene in this is something that just stays with you well after the movie is done. He is more threatening than I think even Kane was, to an extent, because you don't expect it. And this is where we're going to get into it with our critics, but this is where I think the filmmakers are very bold on knowing exactly what they're doing, is utilizing the character to its full extent, to not just make him a prop or not make him something that's just something that's controversial in
just
a movie.
A gimmick, but yeah. Well, I think just the idea of having him be a villain, and such a treacherous villain, really speaks to what Frank Miller, Miner, and Neumeier were doing with their script. Is, if you think about it, the first one and this one have a lot of callbacks to like the old grindhouse Roger Corman films, where you could have a female gangster, you could have a kid gangster. Look at Big Bad Mama. That's a perfect example. You know, you got Angie Dickinson and her two teenage daughters mowing dudes down with Tommy guns. And it's total exploitation, but it could get away with it because it wore exploitation on its sleeve. Where I think this film upset a lot of people is this is still glossy, big budget Hollywood production that has a lot of grindhouse B-movie elements to it, but people weren't really expecting that. But however, you put this movie out now that we've had people like Tarantino that have essentially commercialized exploitation and grindhouse cinema into big, glossy, big budget productions, I think they would look at it very differently now. They would get the joke. But in 1990, no one got the joke. It seemed cruel, it seemed inappropriate, and it seemed unnecessary to have a villain like that in this film. But those of us in the know knew exactly what they were doing, and that's why we like it so much. I want to talk really fast about the filmmaker, the director, Irvin Kershner. So this guy directing the sequel directed quite possibly the most popular sequel of all time, Empire Strikes Back. Arguably the best Star Wars movie of them all. Everyone's favorite sequel. Like you hear which is the best sequel of all time. You're going to get Godfather 2, Empire Strikes Back, and Aliens are usually the three that end up on that list. So I think the producers are really excited to get this guy to direct the movie. And here's the thing. He didn't want another Empire Strikes Back. He was kind of a trashy director. If you've seen The Eyes of Laura Mars, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Empire Strikes Back was like a happy accident for him that he got to make this really prestigious movie, because otherwise, this was the kind of stuff he liked to make, and he makes it without any apologies. It's a total unapologetic picture. It's trashy where it needs to be. It's esoteric and high profile where it needs to be. It's just totally misunderstood, and I think you and I are on the same page of that, but we're not on the same page as the critics. Do you have anything to say about that before we jump into their critique?
And this one, I think, when it comes to the time it came out, and we've covered this before, is this is the time where media was under attack. This is the one where censorship started to crescendo of how we treat our youth. And I think this was a victim of all of that, because if you took a step back from the media, all the press saying what this movie is trying to do is trash, it's trying to manipulate our youth, and even going into a cartoon show to get kids to watch this movie is disgusting, whatever it may be. But this is one that holds true to a social commentary, and Starship Troopers is really resemblance of RoboCop 2 when it comes to its satire. And that one told a commentary. Every one of these RoboCop movies, even if you take the subpar third one, has a subtle commentary to where society is today. And that is the power of cinema, is when you can get a movie on the big screen to convince you of where we're at, to create a world, to create almost a nightmarish world to where we can potentially be. And I think when it comes to Kershner, he does a fantastic job on balancing all of that, where it does feel dirty, it does feel gritty, but it feels real because of that style. This is one of those movies that if you saw it, it stayed with you after your first viewing because of the brilliant filmmaking. So this one is, again, almost level to RoboCop 1. It's hard to take the experience of RoboCop 1, that one initial feeling, and almost match it. And to me, I think it does a brilliant job in a different climate to really match the tone of where society was at that moment. So to me, I think it was a victim of the time of release, but it was well-deserved on the success it had now.
I think the perfect scene to demonstrate what you're talking about is the scene where the Little League coach and all the Little Leaguers are trying to take out that convenience store. Quite possibly my favorite scene in the movie. And the way Kershner does it, it's vicious, it's mean, but it's also very tongue-in-cheek and hilarious when the dude gets his dome blown out, right? But if we had done this with Paul Verhoeven, the director of the first one, I think the cruelty and the meanness would have been less entertaining. It would have been more on point. And the whole point of that scene and what the theme of this movie is that it skirts the line of realism and farce and satire. This one knew how to walk that line. And I think Verhoeven would have pushed it just a little too far into the realm of cruelty, which worked great in the first one, but this one had a different it was telling a different story. And I think Kirshner knew exactly what the story was and did it perfectly. So yeah, I agree with you that this filmmaker was the right guy for it. A guy who could appreciate a little trash with his, you know, big budget movie, but also the willingness to defend it when studios came and tried to pick it apart, right? And bless them for not coming back for the third one, because I feel that RoboCop 3, because it was neutered and made PG-13, definitely hurt it in the realm of like how good it is in the trilogy. It's still a really good story, and I still think there's a lot of good in that movie, but it had its balls taken away. And I guess justifiably so, because this one had more balls than the first one. And so sometimes when you go past that line, they're going to take some of your power away on your next go around. And that's what happened.
It was absolutely an introduction to what audiences weren't ready for going into the sunshine and rainbows of the right. 90s, of what people really wanted to put their butts in seat. People wanted to feel good in a movie, not the satire or the reality of what could be. They didn't want a dystopian kind of world or fantasy, if you will. And I think that really did set a tone to where we're seeing in the next decade. And I'm sure that's going to be a conversation in a lot of different episodes going forward.
Oh, for sure. Especially with movies in the 90s. All right. So this one, Roger brought to the episode.
Our first movie is RoboCop 2. And all during this movie, I kept asking myself, how can a movie this violent and confused also be this funny? It's like there are two movies here. One is an hilarious satire on futuristic advertising, and the other one is an exercise in violence that really offended me with its portrayal of a young boy as a vicious killer. The movie begins with Detroit in still more trouble than it was in the last RoboCop movie, and Dan O'Hurley plays the billionaire who wants, in his words, to take the city private. I couldn't show you because the studio didn't include him in the scenes they supplied. It's a young boy named Hobb, who is played by Gabriel Damon, and is the right-hand man of the drug dealer. This is a kid who looks about 12, and he mows people down viciously with a machine gun and uses a whole lot of R-rated four-letter words. It really disturbed me to see this little boy in this violent role, and it disturbed me even more when I started to think about it, because RoboCop is rated R, but as everyone knows, kids do get into R-rated movies like this one, and even more of them will see it on home video. Was this 12-year-old criminal written into the movie to give the underage viewers someone to identify with? I'd like to think that wasn't possible, but I can't think of any other reason for such an unlikely, depressing, inappropriate, and distasteful script decision. Isn't any age group immune from violent cynicism?
Tell us what you really think, Roger. Okay, I really want to hear what you have to say about his perception. Mine is pretty simple. This kind of goes back to the episode that we did about their violence against women in horror films episode, right? Where it felt like it was just really kind of a publicity stunt. They were really just kind of preaching to the, like you said, choir of censorship that was big in the 80s and 90s. Now, obviously, I feel like he did not enjoy the movie as much as he wanted to, but I feel like he is really going after the bait here. Of we have this young boy who's a villain, and for some reason he thinks that if kids sneak into the movie theater and watch this performance, be it a cautionary tale and everything, the kid doesn't get away with it, it's going to motivate them to be little criminals. That's horseshit.
100% horseshit, because here's what annoyed me about the comment that he was offended. Wrong word. He wasn't offended. He felt bad. He felt uncomfortable. He didn't like what he was seeing. That's not being offended. That's being uncomfortable. He's not used to seeing this on a big screen, especially if he's comparing it to the previous film. This is something where 30 years plus, anybody listening, raise your hand if RoboCop encouraged you to commit violence, because me, it scared the shit out of me. And this underworld of crime doesn't encourage violence. It doesn't push kids to act in a way. This is where we go 3 decades later to prove these two wrong, because this is where censorship got it wrong, because kids did sneak into this movie. Kids did watch this movie. And you know what? Nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
It taught us nothing happened. It taught us something of morality where the filmmakers did it so well, where it made kids scared shitless and made us feel uncomfortable, unlike Roger, where we didn't want to be part of that. And that's part of the power of cinema, is it shows specific examples if it's done well. And yes, it is violent. Yes, it is bloody. Yes, if you're a kid, you probably turned your eyes at the rib cage getting ripped open during the cop cutting scene. So if you were a kid and you just zeroed in on this and smiled, that's a whole different story. But this is one that I think over time, yet again, it's proven these two wrong.
These two were such prudes when it came to violence, but they weren't prudes when it came to sexuality. Even when it was like sexuality with minors in question. Go back to the infamous Blame It on Rio episode. It's such a perfect timestamp of when this was. Because when I was a kid, people cared more about violence and language than they did about sexuality. And then it flipped for some reason, where all of a sudden, okay, well, violence and language are cool, and sexuality is a taboo. And now, anything's game, essentially. And what we're going to see soon is we're going to see the complete inverse of that, where everything's going to be taboo again, right? We're seeing it already. We're seeing like network TV shy away. We're seeing comedies shy away. And then we're seeing companies like A24 pick up those reins and like roll with it. Like, we're bringing adult comedies back. We're bringing ultraviolence back, right? It's just a never-ending ebb and flow of these things. But these two were such hypocrites when it came to this. Like, if you saw them in the 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever the political environment was at the time, they tried their best to stick with it because that's where the ratings were. That's where the advertisers were, right? And you could really see, I'm not going to call it payola, because I don't think it was payola, but they knew that they did have to toe the line for whoever was financing their show at the time, right? If they had a political agenda, they had to kind of work that agenda into their episode and into their critiques. It might have been different on paper, but for the show, definitely. And that's where we definitely called out the hypocrisy on the Women in Horror episode. And I'm calling out the hypocrisy right now on this one.
Well, we also look at the morality of it, because even though without the internet at this point, they know their peers, they know where people are going to lean, and they know when watching a movie, when something doesn't feel right, they have to have the hero element. They have to have that's not morally right element to put on print, to have it known that they don't stand for what everybody else is either saying in their review or the way the political environment is or the way the parents are speaking. They're going to be that person to say, I agree with everybody else that this doesn't feel right. And I don't think it's right to subject kids to this violence. But that's what the rating system for. Who cares if they're going to sneak in? That's not anybody's problem. There's a rating system there. They can sneak in to Blame It on Rio, and that's going to have a more dramatic element than I think RoboCop 2 to an extent.
Agreed.
So it's not their job to say, well, kids are going to sneak into it. So that's a problem. That's why this movie sucks. That's not their job, to admire the boldness and go against what everybody else is trying to censor is their job. Is it entertaining? Yes. Is it bold? Yes. Is it well made? Absolutely. Even to the CGI scenes that we can see flaws now, even with the flaws, it looks fantastic. And back then, it probably looked even better.
Oh, yeah. It was definitely impressive. Well, then Gene has to jump in.
Well, that was my reaction to the picture. I was sort of flabbergasted. You sit there and you know, these words coming out of this kid. Now, I'm a big fan of Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange, which showed people probably more in their 20s, a roving gang, a street gang. And I can understand why that can be done with intelligence and with a point. Here, it's just like they're looking for a new trick, like a different kind of monster. All right, we'll make the kid the killer. And it wasn't even winked at anyway. It was played straightforward and ahead. And you mentioned that a film this funny, there were just a couple of bits, Roger. I mean, you have to be careful. There were a couple of cute bits in the film that are funny.
More than a couple, Gene, but they just are dropped in. It's very strange because the movie is one thing, and then every once in a while, it's like you're watching television, and you get these commercials like the commercials. commercial for the seatbelt that fries
right.
the car thief.
That opens the picture up.
There are several moments like that that I did laugh at, and I thought, gee, this is funny. I'm laughing, and now I'm back to the dreary, depressing movie, which is a mess as far as the screenplay is concerned,
yes.
which is very offensive in the use of this 12-year-old. Now, make no mistake about it. This guy, this kid does kill people.
Yes.
He does take over the drug lord's gang.
Yes.
He does mastermind
And
everything.
It isn't played for laughs
no,
in any way. It isn't played cute. It isn't Bugsy Malone. It's mean-spirited,
yeah.
ugly, and you said the screenplay is a mess. It is a mess. There are stories that are not tied together. In the first film, we had a warm feelings toward
yeah.
this RoboCop
yeah.
uh-huh. character, a man, some kind of mutant in a machine, and here's
another
movie
can't even make up its mind if he's in there
no,
or not.
No.
So here's my thing. We've already played it several times on this show in the 87, 88 episodes that we've done. Gene was an advocate for the first film. He loved the first RoboCop. It was in his 10 best of that year. He's brought it up on multiple occasions when it talks about violence in cinema and how it can be justified based on the story. Now, like I said, this doesn't justify the violence the way the first one does. It glorifies it. But it glorifies it in the sense of it's elbowing you in the ribs, right? You're not supposed to like the violence, so here's a bunch of violence. It goes to like one of my favorite Tarantino quotes when someone asks him, why do you put so much violence in your movies? And he says, because it's fun. That's the whole point. There is an audience for this, and it's just not them. The fact that they spend the entire 3.5 minutes of discourse mostly talking about the boy, this character, Hob, that's who really pissed them off. They don't talk about the effects. They don't talk about the new score that they put in the movie. They don't talk about Weller's performance of how he brings more humanity into RoboCop than he had in the first one. Like, there are so many things they leave on the table because they feel it's more worthwhile to harp about a 12-year-old kid with a machine gun for 3.5 minutes.
The comment from Gene of, Roger, you need to be careful. And that slowly transitioned Roger into agreement or from defense to agreement. And it almost seems like it changed his opinion. And you're absolutely right, is we have movies over movies. And I go back to the element where Roger gave 3.5 stars, I think, to Spider-Man 2. And he brought up the hero element of him being carried along the train. We have the same element here, and almost the internal feeling of being united is present. The hero element is present, and we have all those factors here that really does shout a superhero movie of more human nature, not just violence. We do have, like I spoke to earlier, an emotional element here that our critics are ignoring. And again, Gene is going to focus on the kid being in there and the violence, which we all know he's against. Roger, I would have thought, would have been a lot better than that to appreciate the hero element, the stuck to his guns when it comes to the humor, because it does have some fun, silly moments to it. So I think this is one that Gene got really a hold of Roger, and this should have been an absolute argument, even though this one was two thumbs down on both of them. This was a lame argument between my critic, Roger.
And my critic didn't even have an argument. He just focused directly on the violence inflicted by this 12-year-old kid. And he completely just stepped all over the satirical moments of the movie, specifically the commercial breaks, the funny news stories, right? How we went to war with Mexico and the great nuclear explosion in Guatemala or whatever in Brazil. Like, these are funny things. And they're even funnier now because those news stories almost play like real news stories of the last 10, 15 years. Like, go back and watch the RoboCop trilogy now and see how close it is to home. I've been saying that a lot lately. Just the other day when they put the National Guard in Washington, D.C. to get rid of the homeless people, I'm like, so we're in the RoboCop 3 timeline now, right? That's what we're doing. We've got the special unit to get rid of homeless people. It's hilarious to see some of your favorite sci-fi movies come to life and be like, wow, I'm in it now. You know, I don't have to watch the movie anymore. I'm playing in it. Anyway, I think that the disingenuous nature of this critique between the two of them, focusing on mainly the violence from this kid, the R-rated words that he's saying, blee, blue, blah. You know, it wasn't anything new. We saw this in Goonies where they're dropping the shit word and the damn word and the hell word. Stand By Me, those are foul-mouthed little kids. They loved that movie. This is nothing new. I think the fact that because it has a cruelty behind it, that's the train they're jumping on, where this isn't a precocious youngster or a mop top like Gene likes to say. This is a villain, and they just don't like this kid being a villain, and they're just letting that take over the entire critique of the film.
Recipe for a negative review from Gene is going to be, you have a kid villain. We've seen it time and time again from The Good Son, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to bomb in his review. And it's when we have episodes like this, it's going to be, honestly, my opinion of Roger going up to bat for movies like this. And that's where my disappointment is to see beyond just having something as bold or unique, if I were to say that at this time, of having a kid villain that isn't a violent movie. And I'm not justifying violence, but at the same time, there's a difference between violence and creativity and how it's balanced. And here it is balanced well. It has all these elements from thriller to a cop action to just sci-fi. And it does, it balances it all well. So to me, it is almost a tragedy that these two can't even nitpick a couple good elements out of this. And when one of our critics actually does, he gets that pressure of the phrase, be careful, Roger, and he folds. That is almost a disgrace in a critique when it comes to a movie. Go up to bat for, even if it's a 1.5, 2-star, there's an element there that you can defend against a critic that only has a critique of a boy creating violence, a boy that's violent. And that's my gripe that I've been speaking on this entire episode, because that review stays in the back of my mind as just something that drives me nuts.
So, I mean, this is a very easy score for me. This is a terrible critique. It's not good journalism. It brings no intelligence or good discourse to the conversation. It is literally just him complaining about a 12-year-old boy that swears and kills people. So for that, he gets an F. It's a bad review.
100%. And Roger, I'm back and forth on it, because rightfully so, he goes into some elements that do work. And I can't score him on the back half of the debate, but he does go, there are some funny moments to it. He did like some pieces to it. So, I mean, I will give him that. But I have to say that this is one of my more disappointing debates between these two, because of the exact elements is he doesn't defend his stance of what he started the review with. He ended the review with, yes, 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 in a complete agreement with Gene. And he knows that's not right. He's a smart guy. He knows there's a lot of elements that work, as he said in the beginning of his review. So, but again, I have to be fair. So in the beginning of the review, started somewhat strong, but just tainted at the end. So I have to meet him in the middle at just a solid 2 stars.
Yeah, I don't remember this critique. I don't think I ever watched it. So after watching the movie again and appreciating it as always, like, I watch this movie at least once a year. I can't watch the first RoboCop without watching RoboCop 2 and 3. It just kind of is what it is. Same with Rambo, same with all the Rocky, same with Aliens. I just can't watch one. I have to watch all of them. So this does get some good play at my house. I think that at the end of the day, it's not as good as RoboCop, but it fits perfectly with RoboCop. You know, 3, give or take, you don't need 3. It's there, but you don't need it. But it's a very underrated sequel. I've got other underrated sequels to bring to the table, too. I'm going to leave those for later, but there are some that I feel are very similar to this, where just because it wasn't the exact formula of the first one, it wasn't given the credit that it was due. Because creatively and filmmaking-wise, technically speaking, the movie's amazing. And I don't think that anyone can take that away from me in my terms of appreciation for the movie.
It's rare that movies of the 80s and early 90s that became sequels got the same critique from these two. We had it from Ghostbusters 2. Right? It wasn't like the first one. So this one, if you have the high standard and you're not open to something a little bit different or a different feeling, It's not a standard popcorn flick that we saw. This was released in June. This isn't a good... They wanted something of the first one to entertain going into the summer, and that's not what they got, because this movie doesn't make you feel good. It makes you feel a little icky, but it still entertains, and they weren't ready for the ickiness of a RoboCop sequel.
All right, so good conversation. So next week, as we kind of get closer to spooky season, I'm bringing one last little bit of joy and happiness. I am bringing to the show Baby's Day Out, starring Joe Mantegna and Joe Pantoliano and Laura Flynn Boyle, and one of the most precocious babies you've ever seen on screen, directed by Patrick Reed Johnson, one of my favorite like underground directors. And this is going to be a real fun one, because did the critics like it or did they not? We're going to have to wait and see.
Never in my time knowing you would I have ever thought you would bring Baby's Day Out. So this should be a fantastic conversation.
To me, this is the same as the Cop in the Half conversation, right? Like, this is going to be an episode where it's like, you like that movie? And then you find out lots of people actually like the movie. I don't know your opinion on it, but we're going to wait till the episode to find out. So everyone, thank you for watching, listening. Please rate, review, like, subscribe to our YouTube channel and anywhere podcasts are found. You can find me, Antonio, of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast over at thecultworthy.com. And you can find my friend, Justin Henson, over at
themoviewire.com.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.